I think every American needs to own a bottle of chill pills. I just think, you know, because it's important to take a chill pill every once in a while. Take a few of those. You guys want a chill pill? Take a chill pill. Here you go. Chill pills. Chill pills for everyone. There you go. You guys want some over here? There you go. Okay, there you go. Okay, so here's the deal. You may wonder why the chill pills have a little M on them. Here's what it stands for. It stands for chillax, okay? That's what it stands for. And here's the thing. We have a tendency as human beings, as Americans, as teenagers, as adults, as whoever we are, and wherever we are in life, to freak out at stuff. To do stuff because we're worried, or because we don't think God's going to come through, or whatever it may be. And that can be a bit of a dangerous thing. I want you guys to turn to Exodus chapter 13 tonight. We're going to cover the last few verses in Exodus 13 and then almost the whole chapter of Exodus 14. And we're going to look at a perfect example of this tendency to freak out. Now, it would be nice and it would probably make things a lot easier if there was a pill you could take when you were worried about something. But Jesus gives us a pretty easy formula, actually. He talks about it in Matthew chapter 6. And he says this, don't worry. That's pretty easy, right? He says, don't worry. Just don't worry about it. He says, I take care of the birds. They get to eat every day. I take care of the flowers. They look great every day. I mean, think about it. The birds don't worry about their food. When was the last time you saw a bird pacing around like, oh, what am I going to have for lunch? Oh, I can't find any worms. What? Oh, man, I can't. You know, when have you ever seen a bird worry, right? They don't have to worry because they just know that they'll be taken care of. And if Jesus is going to take care of the birds and the flowers, why would he not take care of us? Well, tonight we're going to look at the Israelites as they have an opportunity to trust God. Unfortunately, they fail the test. But we're also going to look at how God had an opportunity to prove his control that he had over the whole situation. And of course, he passed the test. We're going to, if you hadn't guessed already, or read the screen, we're going to be talking about the crossing of the Red Sea. And there's a lot of different ways people try to depict this story and tell about it. In fact, I brought a bunch of kids' books. Actually, Ariel brought these over here from the bookstore. And there's a bunch of different ways they try to tell this story. The Red Sea is divided. Tells the whole story of Exodus 14. This one is the Pajama Bible in English and Spanish. It says, God opened the Red Sea in the middle. Then God's people walked through the sea on dry ground. There was no mud. These words are in big, bold letters. Not one little puddle. When everyone was safe on the other side, God brought the sea together again. Oh, what a great splash. That's what it says, okay? I'm not going to read the Spanish. I would embarrass myself. Here's another nice picture of it. We've got this little walking through the sea. Here's Moses. We need to go over there, the people say. But a sea was between here and there. How will we get across? The people asked. God will help us, said Moses. Nice. Here's 365 read aloud bedtime stories. So as you can tell, lots of different ways to try to depict the story. In fact, I've even seen a bunch of pictures as well. You can see a lot of cool ones. I like this one right here. I like the octopus. On the side, he's all, with his eight arms, and you got a shark right there. I'm going to eat you. I'm Moses. No, you're not, you know? And then look at how intense this guy is. Oh, I'm parting the Red Sea. You know, his face is all, I think his eyes are weird colors, actually. That's scary. We got, this one's actually pretty intense. I like that. Look at that deep canyon. And I love this one as well. This jagged canyon as you see the millions of people walk through there. Now, if you guys would like, me and a friend put together a little video. We took a kid's video and we did a little of our own editing. And if you guys would like to see it, I'll show it to you. Would you guys like to see it? Okay. So this is just our idea of one possible way that the Red Sea crossing may have happened. It's a 5-minute documentary, so enjoy. Here we go.
And the Lord went before them as a pillar of cloud to lead the way by day, and by night a pillar of fire.
I love fire.
I love starting fires.
It's so warm.
Oh, the fire's out. Why do they call that the Red Sea?
Sure looks blue to me.
I love road trips. I'm thinking of going on a road trip, and I want you to prepare something for me. I want you to go get me some squeeze cheese and some crackers. You? I need you to get me some squeeze cheese. Get me squeeze cheese now. Get me squeeze cheese or else.
Hey guys, let's go for a ride.
Use your toothpaste. I've got white teeth. I've got white teeth.
Pharaoh is coming with his army.
This guy's not even wearing clothes.
That's right, I'm not.
I don't understand why you're making me wear clothes.
Hey, look at me. I look good. When I look in the mirror, I smile.
That's right. He does actually look pretty good. I like it.
It's right, Moses. I just don't see where you're going.
Shut up!
The people begin to murmur, and Moses tells the fat man to be quiet, or shut up. Then he sighs and steps backward onto the rock.
Fat boys,
what you gonna do?
I mean, I am strong.
On Donner! On Blitzen! Let's catch them like Santa and his elves.
You should have ate your Wheaties, Moses.
Bad traits, you go to school and learn the golden rule. So why are you acting like a
Blue Marilel, baby?
What you gonna do? What you gonna do?
On your marks, get set, go!
I dare you to go first.
Double dog Debbie? Okay.
Look at all those little people. I could stomp on them.
Under the sea. Darling, it's bitter. Down there it's winter. Take it from me.
If I could be part of that world.
Oh, man. I am too old for this. Oh.
I wish I had Geico!
Oh, Moses, Moses. I love you, Moses. I love you. I love you, Moses. Listen to me.
So weird, huh? Wizard! Watch my wizard skills.
So I don't know. That was just our idea of how it happened. Did you guys enjoy that? That'll be on our MySpace later on if you want to see it again. Now, I think in reality, I'm pretty sure the parting of the Red Sea was not cheesy and ridiculous like that. I don't think the Little Mermaid had anything to do with it or the theme song from Cops or anything like that, but the reality of the parting of the Red Sea is it's a story of epic proportions where God wins. And that's what I want you guys to catch tonight. Because there's a lot of theories out there as to how this happened or whatever. But it's a really fascinating story, and I think you guys will love it tonight. But before we get to our text in Exodus 13, I want to kind of catch you guys up on the background, right? First of all, God promised, hey, it's just a moth. Have you guys seen those before? Everybody see the moth? You got to see the moth? Okay, now pay attention up here. Ready? Okay, here we go. Bible study or moth? I'll let you choose. Moth, really? Here we go. Where'd it go? God killed it. Okay. Okay, if you see the moth, ignore it. Maybe it'll go away. Anyways, let's move on. Let me catch you guys up here on the background, all right? Early in the book of Genesis, if you guys have been with us on the weekend, we've been studying through Genesis, just finished it up a couple weeks back, but God promised the land of Canaan to his people, the Israelites. Jacob and his family eventually moved down to Egypt during the drought in Genesis 48. And then before Joseph died, Joseph reminded his family that God would visit his people and deliver them from Egypt and take them back to Canaan. Well, it's close to 400 years later, after Joseph has said that, that God finally shows up, delivers his people through this man that we saw named Moses. And Pharaoh refused to let him go. So you guys may remember what happened. Exodus 7 through 12, God, through Moses, brought 10 plagues on Egypt, something that most of these things the world had never seen up until this point. 10 terrible plagues. They turned all the water in the whole land to blood. There were frogs at points that covered the entire land, in people's beds, in their houses, everywhere. There was lice, there was locusts, and of course, the worst of all, the firstborn children of all the Egyptians were put to death. In one night, all the firstborn children died. Exodus 12:31. Says, then he called for Moses, this is Pharaoh, calling for Moses and Aaron by night, and said, rise, go out from among my people, both you and the children of Israel, and go, serve the Lord as you have said. He finally says, that's enough. My son is dead. You've destroyed our land. Get out of here. Take your people and go. And by Exodus 13, where we're about to read in just a minute, the Israelites are leaving Egypt. They're making their exodus. And by this point, it's been a few hundred years. And when we read about Joseph and the promise that he reminded these people of, that God would return and deliver them, the Israelites at that point were a few hundred people. According to Exodus 13:37, there are over 600,000 men who leave the land of Egypt. As you can tell, over the last 400 years, they've grown a lot. In fact, just the men would fill up the whole population of Albuquerque. That's how many men there were. Now, in the Bible times, normally they would only count the men. It didn't even count the children and the women. So we know that the number was somewhere actually close to 2 million people were leaving the land of Egypt all at once. This would make the economy suffer. Things would go downhill quick. These were the workers. These were the people who did all the labor, kept up with the crops and the building and all of these things. Well, tonight we're going to take a journey with those 2 million people as they make their exodus out of Egypt and through the Red Sea. And there's going to be a couple points tonight where I'm going to ask you guys to close your eyes and imagine something, and I want you guys to really be paying attention, because a lot of this, as much as you can take in and try to imagine and experience for yourself, it's going to make it even more vivid in your mind. And tonight what we're going to do is get a reminder that God is in control no matter what happens in our lives. It's a great reminder for us to have. We're also going to look at two things that often try to take control and make us think or sidetrack us from remembering that God is actually in control. So let's go ahead and catch up with the Israelites here as they make their exodus, chapter 13, verse 17. Then it came to pass when Pharaoh had let the people go that God did not lead them by the way of the Philistines, although it was near. For God said, lest perhaps the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt. So God led the people around by way of the wilderness of the Red Sea. And the children of Israel went up in orderly ranks out of the land of Egypt. And Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for he had placed the children of Israel under solemn oath, saying, God will surely visit you, and you will carry up my bones from here with you. So they took their journey from Succoth, and camped in Etham at the edge of the wilderness. And the Lord went before them, as we saw in the video, by day in a pillar of cloud to lead the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, so as to go by day and night. Verse 22, he did not take away the pillar of cloud by day or the pillar of fire by night from before the people. Chapter 14, now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel that they turn and camp before Pi-Hahiroth, between Migdal and the sea, opposite Baal Zephon. You shall camp before it by the sea. For Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, they are bewildered by the land. The wilderness has closed them in. Then I will harden Pharaoh's heart so that he will pursue them. And I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over all his army, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord. And they did so. First thing to remember tonight, God is always in control. Who's always in control? God is always, always in control. There has never been a split second in all of eternity past or in eternity future where God has been surprised by something or where he has lost control. Man, of course, is different. Proverbs 16:9 says, a man's heart plans his way, but the Lord directs his steps. Now, I love trying to picture the scene going on here. These Jews have just been released from a life of slavery, from forced labor. And these people, as they're headed out, this is the only life they've known. They've grown up as a slave. They begin to work as a slave. Many of them, maybe 80, 90, 100 years old, that's all they've ever known. Slavery and forced labor, being beaten to build things or to bring in crops. The Jews have been in Egypt, as I mentioned, for over 400 years by now. And verse 8 says that they were marching out boldly. Try to picture this. They're partying here, okay? These guys don't know anything outside of Egypt, outside of slavery and forced labor. And one day, Moses says, everybody pick up all your stuff. We're free. We get to leave Egypt. These guys are partying. In fact, you can read in Exodus, it says as they were leaving, they started asking the other Egyptians to give them money and gold and silver and animals. And it says the Egyptians gave them anything they want. And so it says that they plundered the Egyptians. They walked away with all of their stuff and their freedom, 2 million people. And they have every right to march boldly like it says. God had just struck the Egyptians with 10 plagues we talked about. But the interesting thing is, even though Israel was living within the land of Egypt, do you know who was saved from all of those plagues? Israel. They lived in Egypt. However, every plague hit all of Egypt except for this part of the land that Israel was living in. God saved his people from every plague. The death of the firstborn. All of the Egyptian firstborn children died in one night. The Israelites, none of them did. God saved them. One time there was darkness for 3 whole days. It was pitch black, except for in the land where the Israelites lived. There was light. God saved his people. They have the right to party, to march boldly, like it says. They were free. God was in control. I want you guys to notice something. Chapter 13, look at verse 17 again. Then it came to pass when Pharaoh had let the people go that God did not lead them by the way of the Philistines, although that was near. Verse 18, so God led the people around by way of the wilderness to the Red Sea. God led them. Even though it was further around, he led them to the Red Sea. God had a plan. Philistine country was much quicker, but God sent them the long way around because he was in control and he had a plan. According to these verses, we know it was God's purpose to plant them here by the Red Sea. It was no accident that they ended up there. Pharaoh looks at him and says, they don't even know where they're going. I hear they're over here by the Red Sea. These guys are trapped in by the land. They don't even know what to do. Let's get them. And that gives them the idea to head out. I love thinking that before Israel ever even knew there was a problem, God had a plan and a solution. Before they ever even knew something was going to go wrong, God had it figured out with the solution. He knew exactly what to do, where to take them, what to provide for them, and what the outcome would be. Before they ever even knew there was a reason to pray and to ask for God. It's the same for every one of you. We all go through a lot of things. Before you ever got that disease, God had a plan and a purpose and a solution. Before your parents ever split up, God had a plan and a solution. Before you messed up your life with drugs or sex or suicide attempts, God had a plan and a solution. No matter what we go through, it does never take God by surprise. God is always in control of every single thing that we go through. And the hard part is, there's a lot of other things that want to distract us from that. Let's look at 2 things that want to try to take control. Number 2, the enemy wants control. Now, let me ask you this. When you guys think of a chariot, what do you think? What do you think of? What comes to your mind when you picture a chariot in your mind? Horses, okay. What else? Cinderella, okay, like a big pumpkin, okay. Lawnmower. I don't know why, but okay. Okay, so we think of a few different things, right? Well, the Egyptian chariots, let me paint a picture of it for you. These were normally pulled by 1 or 2 horses, normally 2 big, strong horses. These were no wimpy ponies, okay? Like, hey, let's go for a pony ride. Yay! Woo! Pony rides and snow cones and candy canes. No, no, no. These were no little ponies that babies could play with. These were full-grown, thoroughbred, strong horses, okay? These were large and in charge. And they were hooked up to these chariots, and these chariots were also very expensive. You can get an idea of it there from the pictures, often covered in gold. The people in the army had to purchase their own chariot, many, many times selling almost everything they had to obtain one of these chariots. Then they had to maintain it and keep it looking good, often covering it in gold to make it stronger. In war, when they went out in war, like you see in the lower left-hand corner, there were normally 2 men in the chariot. One was seated, steering, and the other would stand up and fight. One would have like a shield to guard them, and the other would have, you know, something in each hand, maybe an arrow and a bow, maybe a sword or a dagger in each hand. And these chariots were made to go fast. They were strong and lightweight. And you can imagine when these horses get galloping, they go quick. They get going very fast, and there's a guy swinging a sword as they go by, literally decapitating people as they ride by. That's how powerful this was. Okay? This was nothing to mess around with. And so you could begin to understand why these people might be a little scared. Now I want you guys to do this. Close your eyes. I'm going to read chapter 14. Picture this. Picture this scene. Now it was told the king of Egypt that the people had fled, and the heart of Pharaoh, his servants, was turned against the people, and they said, "Why have we done this, that we have let Israel go from serving us?" So he made his chariot ready and took his people with him. Also, he took 600 choice chariots and all the chariots of Egypt with captains over every one of them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the children of Israel. And the children of Israel went out with boldness. So the Egyptians pursued them, all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen and his army, and overtook them camping by the sea. Now keep your eyes closed. Just try to imagine this, okay? Thousands of horses. They're getting riled up. Hear them. Smell them. Probably doesn't smell great. But get it in your mind. Picture this scene. Thousands of them. You're putting on your armor, metal armor, head to toe. You're going to war and you are ready to kill. You don't care what it takes. You're ready to kill. You have your bow in one hand. You have your arrows in the other. You're ready to kill. You're flying through the desert. Israel has been journeying for days, maybe weeks, and there on the horizon you see them. You're coming up behind them. You can open your eyes. Just picture what these men were doing. Thousands and thousands of these trained soldiers with their horses, with their chariots, with all their weapons, ready to kill people. They were ready at all costs to take lives or to bring back captives. They were angry that they were gone. Pharaoh at this point may have thought that the Israelites were going to come back at some point. You know, there were times where Moses said, "Let us go 3 days into the wilderness and worship our God." Maybe that's what Pharaoh thought. When he let them go, maybe he thought, "I'm just going to send them out and they'll be back." I don't think that's the case. I think he really knew he was letting them go. But once he realized the impact it had for 2 million people to leave his country, these were all the workers. These were the ones tending to the crops. Crops were dying now. The building had stopped. Nothing new was happening. The smell of death was everywhere. Remember, right before they let him go, all the firstborn had died. They didn't have people to bury their dead anymore. All the workers were gone. Pharaoh is furious. And this is how the enemy is in our lives. The moment God does something big in your life, the enemy loves to attack. And that's why people who accept Jesus for the first time are the ones who are sometimes the most vulnerable to that attack. Because the moment God works, Satan also begins to work. And the enemy wants to destroy anything that God has done. The enemy wants control. But God's always been in control. In fact, it's interesting to me that according to verse 4, it was God's idea for Pharaoh to chase the Israelites. As if Pharaoh thought he was in control. "Hey, I have a great idea. Let's go get the Israelites. I wish I could step in there." "Excuse me, Pharaoh, that was God's idea. But hey, go for it. You should, right?" But he thought he was in control. He wanted control. God was in control. Let me give you a second thing that wants control in our lives. It's number 3, and that's worry. Worry wants to take control of our lives. Look at chapter 14, verse 10. The Israelites begin to worry. "And when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes," and of course, the cop song starts playing right then, right? "And behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. Then they said to Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we would die in the wilderness. They see no way out. Now just imagine their fear that must have come over them. Think about it. There's mountains all around. They've probably just come through a mountainous pass where there's jagged, big cliffs right beside them. On one side is Pharaoh and thousands of men of his army running at them with their chariots, knives drawn, bows and arrows. They're ready to attack. On the other side, a big sea. A bunch of water. The Red Sea. Remember verse 8? It says Israel was marching out boldly. Not anymore, huh? They weren't marching very boldly anymore because worry, they've allowed worry to take control of their lives. They've allowed it to take over very quickly as they begin to search for a way out of this situation. Now, one more time. You ready? Close your eyes. Picture this scene. You're in a group of 2 million people. Over the last few days or weeks, you guys have been marching together through the wilderness. Your feet are probably a little sore. You don't know about your surroundings. You look to the right, and there's huge, jagged mountains, cliffs. Look to the left, same thing. Look ahead, there's a bunch of water. That's all you can see is water. Look behind, here comes Pharaoh's army, thousands of horses, warriors running straight at you. Now I want you to open your eyes. I want you to take a look at their view as they got to the Red Sea. This is what they would have seen. And I don't know what you guys thought when you saw when you think of the Red Sea. I don't know if you think of like a big river or a little stream or a nice lake. But look at this. You can barely see the mountains in the far distance on the other side of this. That is completely impossible to swim. There's no way. Trying to swim isn't even an option. You are completely trapped. Mountains on every side, the Egyptians coming to attack, and this huge sea right in front of you. What in the world is going to happen? Worry has taken control because they forgot that God is in control. Look at how quickly they forgot about the miraculous signs that God did in Egypt. I'm sure some of you guys have done this. You're worried about a test sometime before. Like, oh man, I'm so worried. Oh wait, remember something. God's the creator of the universe. I think he can help you. Right? Don't you think? I mean, we worry about a lot of things. You're stressed out about school or about a relationship or something. Did you forget that heaven is free for those who accept Jesus Christ? I mean, when you really put it into perspective, is what you're worrying about something worth worrying about? No, there's nothing worth worrying about. So Jesus says he's going to provide everything we need. He says, seek first the kingdom of God, and I'm going to provide everything that you need. There's no need to worry. Now, the best is yet to come. Here's when the story gets really exciting. Number 4, God proves his control. So God is always in control. The enemy wants control, worry wants control, but God's about to prove that he's the one in control. Now, Moses was a man of faith, and he believed that God had a plan. In fact, he may have remembered, as maybe he was the one who wrote Genesis 1, verses 9 through 10, when it talked about God creating the sea and the waters, speaking them into existence. I wonder if that must have brought Moses a lot of comfort. But I wonder what the people thought about Moses' words. Look in chapter 14, verse 13. And Moses said to the people, do not be afraid. Yeah. Okay, Moses. Great idea. Don't be afraid. Did you look around? Hello, right? Stand still, he says, and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see again no more forever. The Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace. I love that Moses tells him not to be afraid. Makes no sense at first, until you remember that the creator of the universe is on their side. And then it begins to make a little sense, right? They have nothing to freak out about. But it almost seems like Moses freaks out a little bit. Look at verse 15. And the Lord said to Moses, "Why do you cry to me? Tell the children of Israel to go forward." What? Tell them to go where? I think it's interesting that God says, "Why are you crying to me? Moses, what are you freaking out about? Did you listen to your own words that you just told the people? Stand still. I'm going to deliver you. Hello, I spoke everything into existence. Remember that whole thing? You wrote it down in the book of Genesis. Remember that? I got you covered. I got your back, Moses." And God reassures him. God lays out the whole plan. Look at verse 16. "But lift up your rod," God says, "and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it. The children of Israel shall go on dry ground through the midst of the sea. And I indeed will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, and they shall follow them. So I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over all his army, his chariots and his horsemen. Then the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I have gained honor for myself over Pharaoh, his chariots, and his horsemen." Starts to get crazy in verse 21. All right, here we go. Verse 21, skip down. "Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night, and made the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided." The waters were divided. Now try to imagine this night. We read in verse 19 that the pillar of cloud, or you can read in verse 19, the pillar of cloud that was once in front of them moved around to the back so that it blocked the Egyptians. Now between the Israelites and the Egyptians, the pillar of cloud, God is protecting them. He moved from guiding them to guarding them. He's in the back now. He's got their back. He's taking care of them. But verse 21, it says that a strong east wind began to blow all night long, parting the waters. In fact, later on in Psalm 77, the author is writing about this experience. He mentions a lot of things. He mentions rain, lightning, thunder, and an earthquake that took place this night. Imagine how scary and hard of a night this must have been. The pillar of fire is still there, giving them light. They're able to see that, it looks like the Red Sea, it looks like there's a pathway forming. And they're able to see this in the dark of night. God is there showing them the way, lighting them the way. Remember Moses' words. They weren't going to see the Egyptians again. But they begin to walk through this path. Look at verse 22. "So the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea on the dry ground, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left." The Egyptians began to follow them because they weren't going to let the Israelites get away that easy. They follow them. But again, let me remind you of Moses' words. Verse 13, he says, "The Egyptians you see today, you will never see again." Let's find out what happens. Verse 23. "And the Egyptians pursued and went after them into the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. Now it came to pass in the morning watch that the Lord looked down upon the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of cloud and fire, and he troubled the army of the Egyptians, and he took off their chariot wheels, so they drove them with difficulty." How fun would that be, to be God right there, like, "Huh, there's a little chariot, pop that wheel off, pop that wheel off. Oh, look at the horsey, break that leg," right? And he's just letting them have it. Verse 25, "And he took off their chariot wheels so that they drove them with difficulty. And the Egyptians said, 'Let us flee from the face of Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians.' Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Stretch out your hand over the sea that the waters may come back upon the Egyptians on their chariots and on their horsemen.' And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and when the morning appeared, the sea returned to its full depth, while the Egyptians were fleeing into it. So the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. Then the waters returned and covered the chariots, the horsemen, and all the army of Pharaoh that came into the sea after them. Not so much as one of them remained. Not even one of them. Now, let me help you visualize this. We've gone through a lot. We've covered a lot of big stuff. Let me help you get this into your mind here, okay? There's a few different theories on where they crossed the Red Sea. And I've got a map up here from Google Earth. In fact, you can go online to Google Maps and you can check this out. Just type in Red Sea and it'll pull up this picture. And it's this area that we're going to be focusing in here, okay? The Red Sea stretches this whole distance, and that's what I've drawn partway on the board. The Red Sea goes way further down, but this is what we're going to focus on, okay? That's where two theories of where they crossed, okay? First theory I want to point out. First theory is that they crossed somewhere up here, okay? In this area. That's where many people believe. It's real skinny. Probably would have been easy. In fact, a lot of people say that the Red Sea is a bad translation. It's actually the Reed Sea, and it talks about a sea that was very shallow, maybe 10 or 11 feet deep instead of how deep the Red Sea was. And they say that this is probably where they crossed. Now, Egypt is up here, and they believe they would have walked down this way, and there would have been a pretty easy place for them to get through. Many say that that's the way it happened. They say that this place called the Reed Sea is unique because there's an east wind, like it talks about, that comes in. Sometimes it blows so hard that it narrows all the water out and makes it even more shallow. So it would be easy to walk through. But that theory has some holes. First of all, I read that the Israelites walked through on dry ground. I didn't read about them wading through water. Can you imagine them putting on little floaties going across some water? Didn't happen. I didn't read about that. They've also never found a reed sea. They say that it's there somewhere. They've never found it. No one has ever identified all the cities that we talk about here, and yet they try to use those cities to pinpoint that this is the place. That doesn't really work. They've also, this is the biggest thing that kind of disproves it in my mind, they've never found one trace of anybody crossing through here. Wouldn't you think if 2 million people crossed through and then thousands of Egyptian soldiers went through and died, you'd find something? You would think so, right? Nothing at this point has ever been found in this area. Nothing. They just say that's probably where it happened. Here's the second theory, and this is the one that it seems a lot more accurate to me. The theory is they went down this way, and there was a place for them to cross here. They went down here, and so this would have been a longer journey, and they crossed somewhere around here, okay? This is the second theory, and let me tell you why this makes a lot more sense. Now, well, first of all, let me say this. This also has a couple problems that stand out to me. First of all, this part of the Red Sea at its furthest width is 15 miles apart. 15 miles wide. Thousands, literally, of feet deep. In fact, this struck me. Go home, get on Google Maps, and check this out. I zoomed in right here. Look at how deep this is, if you can see it. It's really dark in the middle compared to this, compared to the rest of the Red Sea. This is the deepest, one of the deepest parts of the whole sea. This is completely humanly impossible for people to cross right here. Makes no sense. Except for God was on their side. That's what a lot of people forget. That's what a lot of people overlook. Now, let me ask you this one more time. If 2 million people crossed through here and thousands of Egyptians died, don't you think we'd find something? What do you think? Come on, don't be scared. You think we'd find something? I think we'd find something. I think that there would be something there if that many people crossed through there. Somebody dropped something. Or the Egyptians somehow, I mean, they all died in the sea. Surely there's some sign that they were there. 30 years ago, 1978, a guy by the name of Ron Wyatt, He studied Exodus, looked at it really closely. He said, you know what? I don't think that they crossed here. I think they crossed here. And we're going to fly here. I'm going to take a team of scuba divers, archaeologists, and we're going to dive under the water. We're going to see if we can find something. Check out what they found. Deep underwater, human femur bones. Okay, you know what the femur is? Biggest bone in your body, right here. They found human femur bones. They found horse hooves under the water. You know what's interesting about that? Horses don't live in this part of the world anymore. Why in the world would they find horse hooves under the water? Because thousands of years ago they were there, weren't they? Check this out. A chariot wheel covered in coral. Chariot wheel covered in coral. Chariot wheel covered in coral. Thousands of years as coral and different animals and things grew onto these chariots and pieces of the chariot. I didn't put a picture up there, but there's one picture where they uncovered the gold. You could see it shining underneath the water of a chariot wheel. Only the Egyptians had golden chariot wheels. Now, another interesting thing. The point that they crossed, they believe, is about 10 miles across and about half a mile wide. Now, catch this. This is amazing. This blew my mind. The point that they crossed, there's a gradual slope down like this and then up to the other side where they would have ended up over here. Gradual slope down. However, on this side, there's a really deep part, okay? It's called the Eilat Deep. Any guesses how deep it is? 3,000 feet deep, okay? On this other side, on the south side, there's another deep part, 5,000 feet deep. Now, you're like, oh yeah, that's pretty deep. Let me get that into your mind. Anybody know how tall the statue, the Empire State Building is? 1,250 feet tall, 102 stories, the eighth tallest building in the whole world. You could take the Empire State Building and stack four of them under the water and not even see the top. That's how deep this is. Does anybody know how tall the Statue of Liberty is? 151 feet 1 inch from base to torch. You could fit over 33 of these stacked end to end underwater and not even be able to see them from land. I'm 6'5". You could fit 779 of me underwater. Unfortunately, I couldn't make a picture of that. But now, we don't know how tall the wall of water was that they walked through, because from their discovery, the part that they walked through was a lot more shallow than that. But let's just take a guess. If on one side it's 3,000 feet, the other side it's 5,000 feet, I would say it's a pretty fair guess to say the walls of water were probably about 1,000 feet tall. I mean, I would say that's probably low, if anything. But I would say it's probably about 1,000 feet tall. Now, let's put it in perspective here. Your chairs that you're sitting on. From the ground to the top of the back of the chair, 32 inches, okay? Now, let's just say in proportion that your chairs are at 1,000 feet tall walls of water, okay? If we were walking down the middle, a 6-foot man would be about the size of my pinky fingernail walking through there. Can you try to picture it? Okay, let me help you picture it. I brought a Lego man. Okay, Lego man. I'm going to set him right here. He's actually three times too tall. He's actually three times too big. They would actually, he's like 18 feet tall in proportion right there. But you get the idea, he's really tiny. And to think that he's three times too big, that's just try to get that picture of them walking through. 2 million people. Now let's drive this home. Okay, here we go. Why does all of this matter? Who cares? It's a lot of cool stuff and numbers and yeah, that's nice and all. But who really cares? Why does this matter to me? Why does this matter to you as an Albuquerque middle school student, As a Christian, as a non-Christian, why does this matter? God is in control. You have absolutely nothing to worry about. You're worried about school? You're worried about life in general? Are you struggling with the sin? God parted the Red Sea. I believe he could part you from your sin. He's provided the way of escape. And it had this event had the effect that God was looking for. Look at verse 31. Thus Israel saw the great work which the Lord had done in Egypt, so the people feared the Lord. They said, wow, what were we worried about? God did that. Why was I ever tempted to worry? I have no need. Let me ask you this. Which side are you on? Are you the Israelite? You tend to worry, but you're on God's side, and you're seeing God and his provision. Or are you on the other side, the Egyptian? You're seeing God's provision, but you're also feeling his judgment. Which side are you on? Let me close with this verse, Psalm 20, verse 7. Check this out. It's perfect. Some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we will remember the name of our God. We should be trusting in nothing besides God himself. That's the only person, the only thing that's in control. Worry will try to be in control. The enemy will try to take control, but God is in control. And tonight, if you need to surrender your life to this God who can split the sea wide open, tonight's your night to do that. Because when you walk out the door, it may be too late. I don't say that to scare you. I say that because it's reality. Those Egyptians, when they woke up that morning, didn't think that was their last day on earth. And every one of us is going to die one of these days. Are you right with the Lord? Let's pray. God, we thank you that you are a miracle-working God, that you're huge, you're in control, and we have nothing to worry about. We're trying to visualize how huge this is. God, it's amazing. Our minds can't fully understand how incredible this was, but this is so tiny compared to you. As huge as the Red Sea was and as huge as it was for you to part it, God, the Bible tells us that you hold the universe in the palm of your hand. For us to worry is a joke. There's no need for it. And Lord, I know that I'm prone, just like any human is, to worry, to wonder how you're ever going to provide. This week, Lord, help us to live as though you are in control. And we thank you, just like this story showed us, that even when things went wrong, you had a plan and you had a solution before the Israelites even knew something was going wrong. Pray for every student in here tonight, Lord. We sang the song, "Let us be a generation that seeks your face." God, that is my prayer for these students, for myself. Let us stand up for what's right and make a difference in our generation. In your name we pray. Amen. Leaders, we'll be up here at the end if you guys need to talk or pray with anybody. Otherwise, have a fantastic night.